Welcome to our third podcast. Today we're going to be discussing ordinary people. I am Dr. Scott Wickman.
I'm Olivia Brooks.
I'm Tony Gary.
And I'm Adam Gregory.
And we want to send out our support and well wishes to our colleague Anna, who was not able to make it today. So our thoughts are with you, Anna.
They definitely are. And we would also like to send a big congratulations to you, Scott, for finishing the Chicago Marathon yesterday. And you're here today, so still walking.
Yes. Barely.
Well, you made it, so yeah. That's a step.
All right. Well, thank you. So I want to say I have some bias related to ordinary people because, I watched it. And it's like being back in high school for me because it was shot in the area where I grew up. Largely, it was shot in Lake Forest and Waukegan, which is my hometown, and some scenes in the Lakehurst Mall, which I think is now defunct. And I remember it was a big deal in Waukegan and at Waukegan East High School when we had Robert Redford coming to town, and this film was his directorial debut. I think somebody from our school newspaper got to interview him, and in addition to all of that, just another thing. So, and then in my current role here as a counselor educator, last year about this time, I did an internship site visit to Lake Forest High School, where this was filmed. And at that time, they were putting on the theatrical version, the play of Ordinary People in that high school. So it brings back memories for me. Just some other things about Ordinary People before we begin. Stars Timothy Hutton playing Conrad Jarrett. Real large focus on the Jarrett family. Also, Mary Tyler Moore as his mom, Beth. Donald Sutherland as Calvin, Conrad's father. We've got Judd Hirsch playing Dr. Berger, who is the psychiatrist. Elizabeth McGovern as Janine Pratt, Conrad's girlfriend, and then some other people in more supporting roles. And as I was watching this film, one thing I noticed since we've been starting to do this podcast is I look at films differently when I'm looking at it for the purpose of being able to talk about it on the podcast.
I definitely agree.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, you know, just like, I also like have a little bit of a connection with the film just because it was shown in my high school. It was made before I was born, actually, but my principal loved this film and showed this film, and I love movies. I love Academy Awards for some reason. I just really get into it.
Yeah.
And I tend to forget this is what Robert Redford won his Oscar for. Like, it was for directing. I tend to, for some reason, I think of him more as an actor, even though he directs quite a bit. And it also made me realize Mary Tyler Moore is an incredible actress, because I only knew her from her show, and not that she wasn't good in it, but it was early, and it was like a modern day or a post Murphy Brown kind of role.
Oh yeah, it actually was. I don't want to talk too much about it, but the Mary Tyler Moore show, it was really like a real early feminist.
Yeah.
I think it might have been done by Norman Lear. I'm not sure.
I don't remember. It was just such a departure from that role, though, in Ordinary People.
And shot in the city of Minneapolis, which is also near and dear to me because my favorite band, The Replacements, are from there. And I always remember that scene at the opening credits where she, like, flips her hat up in the air. And also Mary Tyler Moore on The Dick Van Dyke Show, which you can still see on MeTV.
Yeah.
So those are some of our connections. So what I notice, I have seen this film at least 10 times, maybe 20. I used to own it on VHS. That's how far back it goes for me. And even though I've seen it all these times, an epiphany I had while watching it for this is I think this film centers largely around Conrad's relationships with other people. And I even thought we might structure our conversation around that, or something else could happen too, and, mm-hmm. and we'll just see how that goes. A lot of what this film is about happened before the film, before the opening of the film. Mm-hmm. And so we're kind of seeing the ripple effect or the implications of a couple major events. This Jarrett family living in Lake Forest, which is a very affluent suburb of Chicago. They had this sort of perfect family, blissful life until Conrad and his brother Buck were out boating during a storm, and the older brother Buck ended up drowning. Then, probably related to that, Conrad attempted to commit suicide. And as we pick up the film, that had happened several months earlier. Conrad now is back in school and he's trying to adjust, and the family has been disrupted a little bit, a lot actually. Yeah. And so we get to see Conrad's work with Dr. Berger, which reminded me somewhat of the Sean Maguire character played by Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting. We see a lot of family dynamics going on.
A lot.
And what else? Oh, and then Conrad's sort of social interactions with his peer group. Mm-hmm. Play a major role as well. And there's even the minor character of the swim coach who has a couple mm-hmm. zingers in there. The mental health issues. I thought this had kind of a plethora of mental health issues. The ones that I spotted, and I may have missed some, certainly grief and loss, mm-hmm. survivor guilt, family systems issues, suicidal ideation, insomnia, PTSD, survivor guilt. And something else that I was not sure of, but I thought might have been alluded to, was alcoholism. And that would be Calvin. And there's about four scenes where there is a suggestion that he's using alcohol as a way to cope.
Mm-hmm. To me, like, on top of all those, I kind of felt like with, what was the main character's name?
Conrad.
Conrad.
Yeah.
With Conrad, he kind of had a little abandonment.
Oh, yeah.
Because as far as family dynamics go, like, you can tell towards, like, the first couple of scenes that, like, there was clearly a favoritism mm-hmm. between the brothers, and the mother favored, you know, Buck more than anyone. So I kind of saw at the beginning that he was dealing with, like, abandonment, that even though your mom's in the house, like, you know that you're not her favorite, and then you have that on top of survivor's guilt, and
yeah,
that kind of, like, set the tone for the entire movie. To me, his relationship with his mom was the most important, because there was so much tension the whole movie, and I was trying to figure out, like, okay, is there going to be a breaking point? Is there going to be a tipping point? But it was very, like, it was very real. And then I read some trivia.
Oh, okay.
And I found out that Mary Tyler Moore was going through a separation with her husband around the same time the movie was in production. And Timothy Hutton Mary Tyler Moore's son, I think, died by accident. And she was going through, I think, a separation, and Timothy Hutton.
Yeah.
My bad. He had a death in his family as well, mm-hmm. but both, like, said that they weren't really putting that emotion into the roles, but you can still kind of mm-hmm. see it. Mm-hmm. because I was like, wow, they're really, really good at this. But then I read the trivia and I'm like, they have a lot more like underlying emotions, which made it, I mean, it's, you know, it sucks, but it kind of like made it more realistic for them. And I was watching it because I read the trivia before the end of the movie. So when I watched the end and I was like, oh man, that's probably heartbreaking for her. When she was, like, packing her stuff.
Well, I thought that was such a poignant, powerful scene that all through this film, she's coming across, I don't know if we can swear on here or not.
I think we should.
She's coming across kind of like a bitch.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, shallow, superficial, rejecting. And then it, just at the very end, that packing scene. She's by herself. She knows she's leaving her family behind temporarily or more. We don't know. And we just see her. I'm shaking my head and I'm trying to make a face.
She's flustered.
Yeah.
I do think, though, I remember watching this in the early 2000s when I was in high school. And I had never seen it prior to that. And I'd be curious to see what the reaction would have been from people watching it in the early 80s when it was released. I think 80 was when it was released. Because I even remember thinking in high school and having the discussion, like, wow, she is a bitch. Like,
yeah.
And you really have this distaste. Just, we don't like her. She's a bad mom and a bad person, and you just don't like her. But watching it this time, I think after a lot of, I mean, we've come forward as a society when it comes to different things with feminism and with just women playing different roles. We don't necessarily see the family dynamics of the day that we used to, where the mom has to be the caring one and the dad has to be the money earner. Like, we see it already breaking up in this day and age. And I didn't get the bitch impression from her at all this time around. I actually had much more, like, a lot of empathy and sympathy even for her, which I know we're not supposed to have like sympathy, but I did.
Well, she's not your client.
Yes.
So.
I was crying watching her character. Like, yeah. I felt more for her than I did for even the other characters, which was strange for me.
I felt like she was stuck in the angry stage of grief. Like, it's just like perpetual like anger.
Yeah, and I did some research on it because I was curious about, like, there's, like, the rebuilding self model after a bereavement in the family and stuff, which I had never gone into before, that have kind of different stages as well, which I'd be interested in chatting about at some point. But, you know, I want to make sure everyone gets the chance to talk about Mary Tyler Moore in this role.
Well, I think in terms of back of what Tony was saying about the family system, and even in the beginning when Scott was saying, you know, they're this ordinary, you know, life is good. However, from the outside looking in, it can appear that way. But I looked in depth to how Conrad was reacting. And then even the father's kind of like breakthrough when he's speaking to her. When he's talking to Dr. Berger, he's saying like, you know, has your wife showed you any emotions? And it's, you know, it was kind of like almost excitement, like, oh, she loved Buck, she loved them. And it's just like, with the rest of us, we're here. So to me, I saw avoidance in her, like strong perpetuating. And it was, what is the breakthrough that would help her? Because when he was speaking, it was almost as if like, I can see that, you know, I'm here for my son. I don't really need it. But it's kind of like he planted the seed, and when he went home, he continued to think about it. And so I'm curious about her experience. And maybe it could have been related to like Good Will Hunting, where you need more than one person to see before you actually feel like you can open up. But I feel like the family system itself, there was already some things going on, but having him there without the loss, it kept everyone in their system functioning as they did, whether that was Dick's function to one person or just functioning to another. So.
Yeah, I very well said. So this was how the different people were coping. It also functioned to keep the family going. And she was trying to hold it together.
Mm-hmm.
I know that loss of a child is the most difficult thing a person can ever experience. And I want to call attention to two scenes. So even though she's experienced that, but she's still trying to have life as normal, her ordinary life. Mm-hmm. And she's really concerned with social appearance, etc. Absolutely. Now, so we get a flashback. Actually, these are pretty close together. We get a flashback of her laying outside, playing with Bucky, and Conrad's there as well. And Buck is telling the story about being a senior. He's a senior in high school. Mm-hmm. He's talking about his girlfriend and him getting really drunk or something like that. And she's laughing. She goes, "Oh, Bucky, stop."
Yeah.
And we see this, like, side of her that we never see in the rest of the film.
Absolutely.
And what immediately, so that was a Conrad flashback, and what had immediately preceded that was that Conrad had walked in on Beth in Buck's room, which appears to be being maintained kind of as a shrine to him. Mm-hmm. We've still got all the trophies on the wall and awards, and it looks probably exactly like it did the day that he died.
Yeah. And I, to kind of like piggyback off the, she's trying to keep up this perception of, you know, that they're okay and the neighbors, you know, what are they going to think of it? When she just even breaks the plate, there's this whole part where she's like, "I think it's going to be okay, though. Like, it's a clean break. We can put it back together." Yeah. And I thought that played such a huge role into what she was trying to do with her family.
Yeah.
Even though it's clearly affecting her, and she may never be the person she was before, appearances is what it's about. It's a clean break. And if we can make it look like it's glued back together, like the plate, then we're going to be okay.
Yeah.
When she really wasn't taking a look at the fact that something severely broke here.
Yeah, and that's what I think part of that avoidance. It's almost, we're not going to discuss it. Even the flashback of Conrad thinking about that, he was actually there, but nothing in the flashback says any affection, any conversation actually included him.
Yeah,
so
correct.
It's showing, I was already excluded before this even happened. And now, because of his death, it's been, you know, intensified. Mm-hmm. And her, and I guess almost that sense of avoidance toward him or neglect was already there. Mm-hmm. He's not included, he's not laughing, it's not, "Oh, comrade, come here, how was your day, what's going on?" It's just isolated. Them seeing her in a different light and then him still being there but not being there and included. So watching that was interesting. But then also, I think about the scene with them taking the picture.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I can take the picture, but I can't be in it, because to be in it, once I look at it again, I'll notice someone missing, and I can't have that.
Exactly. Wow.
So.
Yeah.
I'll take a picture of anyone, but like, and it also goes with that abandonment. Like, she tries very hard to stay as far away from Conrad as possible. Even when, like, he's trying, and when he said, "Oh, I got a, what was it, a 74?
On trig.
Trig. And he was trying to, like, extend branches, and she kind of just, like, shrugged him off and made some comment and went to the room and closed the door. It was just, like, he kept, like, hitting, like, a wall when it came to her. And even after he had his, like, turning point where he, like, was talking to the doctor, he was talking to Burr, and he was crying, and then, like, he was, like, really, you could see he was, like, it was, like, a weight kind of lifted, and he went and hugged his mother, but she just looked, like, starstruck.
Oh, like, the look in her eyes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then intense. The look from Kelvin?
Kelvin,
okay. Yeah, when he saw that, I think then it clicked to him, like, this is not the family that I've been trying to save. So I think that's when he gave up. I was hoping that interaction between Beth and Connie would be like, okay, so then they'll try to, you know, mend things, but then I realized the movie was called Ordinary People for a reason. It's not like, you know, they don't do things for Hollywood's sake.
Well, I also, like, I love that you brought up the points that, like, you know, she was kind of distant toward him from the get, even when Buck was still alive. I remember talking to one of my professors in my master's program. He had asked us what our favorite movie was, and I said, I can't pick a favorite movie. It's like asking a parent to choose a favorite child. And he was like, well, I have a favorite kid. We all do. And it, I mean, parents do. They have favorite children. And when we talk about the survivor guilt, I think not only is Conrad going through this huge survivor guilt, but the character, like Mary Tyler Moore's character, is also angry that her favorite died. And that the one, she loves her other kid, I'm sure. Parents love their children in different ways. But the one you really wanted to see come back after an accident didn't come back. So she has this anger toward him for living when her favorite died. Mm-hmm. It's not right, but it's there.
And I think the father, Conrad, was his favorite. Because whenever Beth and Kelvin would get into an argument, she would be like, you're always taking his side. You always let him do that. You always let him walk all over you. And it will be like attacking him when, like, about Conrad. And you can see, like, he's always like vouching for him and trying and, you know, like talking to him like with soft tones and are you okay? I think it's also because he was the one who found Conrad, like, after his like suicide attack.
Yeah.
So he feels like not another one. Like, you already lost one son. He's trying very, very hard to make sure his other son stays like with the living and stays like wanting to live.
Mm-hmm.
And Beth just doesn't care. She just wants to do stuff with Kelvin. Like, kind of forgets that she has another child. I think she just wants to be okay with traveling and just being her and her husband minus children.
Yeah. And I think that was a good point as well, because when Conrad, you mentioned how Kelvin may be trying to keep him from committing another attempt, and I think that in itself says something. I don't know what was going on with my son to get him to this point, but if there was any neglect, I want to be here so he can have someone in his corner. And then to even suggest him getting help, that in itself, like, the mother was like, eh, you know, I thought that thing was over with. And that in itself is like, well, I still think if he needs it and he wants to go, you know, I'm up for it and I encourage it, versus saying, you know, that was months ago, let's just move on. Mm-hmm. He's, no, if there are any kind of like unfinished business, you know, please talk to someone. And then the fact that he even went for himself and started talking, I think that was saying there's some things going on, and before we handle it with a negative coping skill, let's get help. So
I think she just didn't want any of that at all. He's seeing a doctor, don't tell people. That's no one else's business. It makes us look bad that we mm-hmm. can't handle our own. Also, when they had that fight during the time that I think they were putting up the tree, and he's like, you know, what if this was Buck? And she's like, if Buck would have lived, we wouldn't be going through this. Mm-hmm. Like, just that perception.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to clarify, because I think the specific words were important in that scene. I forget what preceded it, so they're fighting.
It was like how sparse the tree is or something.
Yeah, there was that, but so Beth never went to visit Conrad in the hospital.
Yeah,
Conrad says, you would have gone to visit Buck in the hospital.
Yeah.
And Beth says, Buck never would have been in the hospital.
Yeah.
Wow. Touche.
Yeah. But that was so intense that he actually said the words. Because it's one thing to kind of have those emotions, and he reacts in his behavior. Their interactions are based off of those feelings. You never visited me. You didn't really care. But to actually say that to her, and then I feel like it was kind of like a bam with him and then a bam with the husband.
Yeah.
But it was kind of like, you know, they've been harboring these feelings, and I think the harboring of those feelings came from kind of trying to keep that family system. And just because that's the family system, it doesn't mean that it's one that works for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people still suffer within those dynamics.
A couple things related to family dynamics. So I wanted to throw in from Family Systems 101, that although family sibling roles within mm-hmm. families, and although it doesn't have to happen this way, but what is most common is for the oldest child to be the hero or the star, and the second to be in that scapegoat or problem child. Mm-hmm. And I think we saw that in this film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like middle child syndrome potentially, because yeah. there's always the possibility of a third.
Yeah.
And the third is usually seen as like the baby and is babied, and by then the parents know what they're doing.
Yes, so exactly.
It's like the oldest is like their pride and joy. The middle is like, eh. We could have did better, but, you know, what's done is done.
It's if the oldest is successful.
Yes, if the oldest is successful. Because
sometimes the first pancake doesn't come out right.
Are you a middle child?
I'm a first. The pancake came out right on this track.
I make good pancakes.
I'm sure.
Unless, you know, have, like, great genes, like, you know, the Peytons or, like, the Knowles, and then you're just, the whole family is successful.
Oh, yeah.
And it doesn't matter what age you are. But that's not the case, because this movie was made in 1980.
Yeah. So I want to go back to Beth's reaction to Dr. Berger.
Mm-hmm.
And saying, you know, why do we really even have to do that? And yeah. So I'm going to make a little segue mm-hmm. here. To the supporting character of Karen. Karen was a friend of Conrad's at the hospital, and Conrad says he's even nostalgic for their times in the hospital. Mm-hmm. That's where they had fun, they could be themselves, didn't have to worry about being judged by other people. Mm-hmm. Wonder where that came from. And so they get together at a restaurant. And Karen says she was referred, that the psychiatrist at the hospital referred her to another psychiatrist, which we could infer is Dr. Berger,
mm-hmm.
because it was the same psychiatrist making a referral both for Conrad and for Karen. We don't know that for sure, though.
Okay.
And Karen says she's stopped seeing the psychiatrist because her dad says she should be able to solve problems on her own. And it kind of gets into that Western culture notion of rugged individualism, and everybody should be able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps, which of course assumes that you have boots. And then she makes a slip up that she twice talks about, that she's in this play that they're putting on called A Thousand Clowns or something like that, which has a new meaning today, you know. But we don't need to talk about that. And so she forgets that she's already told Conrad, which kind of foreshadows that things aren't entirely right with Karen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then she takes this Pollyannic, optimistic, like, let's have the best Christmas and best year ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She reminded me of his mom in that
movie. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Very avoidant of that time that they were there. Moving on, let's move forward. Almost like, let's plan the next trip. So.
I found it interesting that she said, at first she said, let's have the best Christmas ever. And then backtracked and said, let's have the best year. And then when he ends up calling her around New Year's, he finds out that she, like, committed suicide. And I found that interesting because it was after Christmas. So she said, let's have the best Christmas ever. But what happens when Christmas is over?
Yeah.
What, like, how do you make the rest of your year the best? So I kind of feel like that was a little bit of, like, ominous.
Yeah.
Because she said Christmas and then she just, like, neglected the rest of her life and then had to backtrack and say it, but maybe I was just reading too deep into it.
Well, and I think we're kind of seeing, like, Beth saying to Conrad or to Calvin that Conrad doesn't need these psychiatric services, But then we see what happens with Karen when her dad said, you don't need these, and...
Yeah, she's like, well, at least that's what my dad says.
Yeah. And even with receiving the services, so then after Conrad finds out about Karen's death, he goes off, and he goes into the bathroom, he starts the cold water, we again see the vertical lines on his wrists, but then he gets out of the house and he contacts Dr. Berger, and he knows what he needs to do to get help and to get support for himself. So he's making a wiser choice.
I found that in contrast to Good Will Hunting, where it was mandated, Conrad willingly wanted to go see someone. And for him to still be in high school, I don't really remember if he was like a junior or senior, sophomore.
I think he was a senior.
Okay. For him to be like that young and seeking help and like his parents aren't really pushing him to do it, I found that really interesting, and I'm glad that they showed that, because usually people think like, oh, your parents push you to go.
Or I feel like there was a little push by dad.
A little bit.
Well, not suggestion. Yes. Yeah. It was a suggestion, but then like when things got too rough and his parents went out of town.
It was his own decision, absolutely.
Yeah. And I really liked Berger's character, because I had my own biases on psychiatry, because I just thought it was, have a short discussion, administer some medication. If you really want to talk to someone, we have someone like a specialist for that. I didn't know that psychiatrists actually will sit down and have like sessions with you. So I'm really glad that they like spotlighted that, because I think that's a common misconception where it's just, oh, we're just going to talk for like 5 minutes and then you give me some medication. But I've seen other TV shows like that are modern that show the same thing with psychiatry. So I was really glad that he took on, it was kind of the same, like, what are you here for? I'm not just going to give you medication. We're going to talk about it first. So, and I don't think he even gave him medication throughout the whole
movie. And he asked for tranquilizers, and I don't think he prescribed them.
Yeah. I'm curious what you guys think of the doctor role and kind of how that, because I had a strong opinion as well, but I want to hear what other people think.
Well, it took me a minute to get over the fact he was smoking in session.
1980?
Yeah.
I just don't. It's just, it would have been, it would have took me a minute in session to say, do you know if I have asthma? Like, anything. Honestly, it literally, I just paused and I was like, okay, let me just focus on this.
I think they were still smoking on planes.
So,
oh, they were. That was in the film. They said as they were like the flight to Houston was landing, they're like, please extinguish all smoking materials.
No way.
So that's what I initially had to get over.
Same.
And then after that, back to his initial kind of like the intake process.
Yeah.
So why are you here? What's going on? And Conrad was just like, don't you have it? Don't you? Talk about it. And it was very kind of aggressive, but very not too aggressive for Conrad, in a sense that he let him reveal what he wanted within his time. And acknowledged, I think he kind of acknowledged it in the beginning, saying, oh, you talked about that, referring back to his brother with the previous person. He was like, yeah. But eventually, he actually would come to share more, but kind of like testing the water to figure out, you know, are we going that deep today? Or, okay, not, you know, it's like that dance of, you know, getting to know Conrad and letting him know, like, I'm not going to let up. He was so chill also, very comfortable and confident. So, and I think that kind of was reflective in what you were saying about, like, Sean. Just, you know, I can do this, you know. Kind of very seasoned and saying, you know, someone may call this difficult or whatever it may be, but, you know, I can get through. I'm willing to work with you if you want it. And I can see him doing those stages of change. And it was so, with him and the dad, and I was like, oh, that's so perfect. He was phrased so well, just trying to figure out, like, what's going on with both of them. Even back to when I mentioned earlier with the dad, like, oh, Is that something you want to change? You know, she's not that affectionate with you. How is that being for you? And it was just, how is this? How is that? Oh, is that something you wanted to change? Oh, no? Okay. Well, kind of putting it on them to figure out what would you like to change or what would you like to get help with. So
I want to go back to what Tony was talking about with Conrad being in high school and still going through his own will. And in addition to, and it isn't like he did this that he in a vacuum. So other people are aware that he tried to kill himself and are aware that he is seeking professional psychiatric mental health services. And he gets flack for that from peers.
Mm-hmm.
There's some making fun of. And in addition to that, the swim coach himself.
Yeah.
And there was a quote in there, which I was actually personally happy. I put it in my notes, and then I watched the trailer, and they included this line in the trailer. That is the coach saying to Conrad, "I never would have let them put electricity in my head."
Mm-hmm.
And again, there's that rugged individualism. Can't you get your stuff together? And
also just the curiosity the coach has. Because I think we all kind of do that before working with clients. Like, what did you talk about? What's that like? Like, people are very curious what goes on in especially something like a hospital more than just a session. And the coach shows that, like, complete lack of understanding about what mental health issues are.
Yeah.
It's kind of like they're just giving him a reprieve. Like, yeah, you were in a boating accident and your brother died.
But by the way, did they shock you?
Right. Like, yeah, it's kind of just like they're more, oh, so you had a death in the family. That's why we're kind of letting you slide with some things. But you're going to see a psychiatrist. Like, who does that? And blah, blah, blah. And it, like, even though all of his friends knew, like, I didn't know until the very end that one of the friends was also friends with his older brother.
Yeah.
So it was interesting because I had to, like, think back to all the interactions with the swim, like, player, well, the swimmers, and I was like, oh, that's why he was always, like, if someone would say something, you could distinguish them because the jerks were always in their Letterman jackets.
Oh.
Very stereotypical.
Wow, I didn't pick up on that.
Yes, the jerks were always in their Letterman jackets. And the friend never wore his jacket. Conrad never wore his jacket. And the friend never said anything, like, mean until they got into it. And then the car scene happened.
Yeah.
But that was interesting because it's kind of like, oh, it's okay that your brother died, but it's not okay that you're going to see a psychiatrist. Maybe you should just not do that. Just go to swim practice. You'll be better.
And there, what preceded, I think, the scene where there was the altercation between Conrad and the letterman jacket person. So Conrad has quit the swim team.
Yes.
And the other swimmers, varsity swimmers, are coming out, and we overhear them saying, if we have to hear the Buck Jarrett speech again.
Yeah.
So apparently the coach has some speech about how great and what a leader and putting Buck Jarrett, who is now passed away, up on a pedestal. And that also lets us know what a shadow that Conrad is living in. And probably that was happening, as we've said, even when he was alive,
mm-hmm.
when Buck was alive.
There's a touch of irony that he died in a sailing accident, and he was a swimmer.
Yeah.
A champion swimmer who died while in the water. It's mm-hmm. very ironic.
So, speaking of the irony, I thought of Titanic, just the way they were having it, in addition to the fact that he's a swimmer. It was just like, just very interesting that, and then I think when he's in session, he says, "Why'd you let go?" And I'm just like, you know, darn, I never watched Titanic from this lens, but who knows? It was just interesting. But yeah.
Well, and I'm going to want to come back to Dr. Berger, but I want to touch particularly on that scene where Conrad is reliving the accident, and he's talking to Buck, saying, "Why'd you let go, you jerk?" Or something like that. And that Conrad has a Freudian slip. It might be even right before that, in the session with Dr. Berger. And he says, I need to find it. Yeah. Conrad says, if you think I'm going to forgive, that she's going to forgive me. And he kind of has this epiphany that it's really he needs to forgive himself. Mm-hmm. It isn't that he needs forgiveness from his mother.
Is that when he was like looking out the window or something and he's like, I know what needs to be forgiven by who?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. That, I have that written down. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I had to like go back because I couldn't hear it at first. I was like, what did he say? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that part was it. That whole scene was very... So, you know, we were discussing how the Good Will Hunting scene, when he was just like, it's okay, it's okay. And then eventually he started crying, and I said it wasn't that realistic. I felt that this was more realistic because Connor had a lot of, like, triggers. And I think that the main trigger he had was finding out Karen committed suicide because he just flipped. And then he started reliving everything over, and it kind of... He realized that, like, it wasn't his fault. It was literally an accident because his brother was joking around. And I know, well, from my point of view, I feel like his brother was trying to joke around to make sure his younger brother was not so scared. And in that, he kind of, like, slipped and fell under the current. But I think that Conrad realized that, like, he had to hold on because, like, his brother would have been mad if he didn't hold on. So it's kind of like survivor's guilt, but at the same time, it's like, you know, your brother wouldn't want you to, like, suffer anymore. So there was a lot going on with that scene. And then they hugged, and I was like, okay, I guess that's okay, because I have an issue with this whole, like, hugging the client. And I was like, okay, well, he's crying, so it's okay. It was kind of out of the blue, but okay, I had to get over it. It was only like 5 seconds, but that's an issue I'm having.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back and focus again a little bit on Dr. Berger and his style, and some of the words that I think of and thought of when I was watching Dr. Berger and Sean McGuire. Authenticity. That seemed to be so important. And not taking the pseudo bullshit expert role and pretending that you're the know-it-all. And so things like the smoking, which was socially acceptable in 1980 and not now. And what else did he do? Oh, he cursed. Yeah, and he talks in sort of casual, informal language. Mm-hmm. He's willing to meet Conrad in the middle of the night after, you know, Conrad found out that Karen had killed herself. And he's like real. He's so real. And I think that that's what makes a difference.
I was curious as to why their conversations were always so, like, it seemed jerky to me. Like, it won't be like a full sentence. It will, like, Conrad will say something, and I know, like, his personality, he was portraying someone who was kind of like spastic, but it seemed like when he would be talking with Berger, he would say something and then Berger would say something, and it was just like a constant game of ping pong. It wasn't like, okay, you say something and you say something. There were no long-winded explanations or anything. And I think it goes along. Well, personally, I was like, was this how all movies were?
That's what I was going to say. I think it was a little more stylistic of, like, directing and script writing than to do something like that.
It seemed more, well, I don't know, but how Good Will Hunting was more like, oh, they did it for Hollywood's sake. I think since this is 1980, they don't really care about Hollywood's sake. It's just like, we're going to make this a great movie. So the conversation style was kind of hard to follow, but I was like, maybe it's just a directing style and that's not how like psychiatrists or like counselors are supposed to like just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. It almost seemed like an argument in a way, but it wasn't, like you said earlier.
He was challenging. Berger was willing to challenge. And so he did not hold back. He didn't pull any punches. And it seems like that's what Conrad kind of needed. And Conrad even says that at the very end. He says that to Calvin.
Yeah.
Come on, you need to... I forget what he said.
He's like, you need to get on me more.
Yeah.
And Calvin was like, well, I never had to worry about you. And then I think Conrad said something like, but I still, like, something around the lines, like, I would still like you to. And then they finally tell each other they love each other. And neither one of them heard that the whole movie from anyone. I don't even think Beth said it to Calvin. So I think that part was really, like, it's like, we're in this together. So
in the scene where Beth walks in on Calvin at the dining room table in the middle of the night, and this is another time where I think Calvin had been drinking, and Calvin asks Beth, do you love me? And her response is, I feel the way about you that I always have.
Yeah.
Can you answer the question?
I loved it. I did.
But that reminded me of Calvin and the in the psychiatry session when he responded to, well, we've been together for X amount of years.
21, yeah.
So it's just, it's one of those things, well, it's been this way, and as if years amount to love, or they're the same, or we're speaking the same language. So.
Well, and I think it was also time. You know, 80s was nearly 40 years ago at this point.
Okay, just make me feel old.
But I think that plays a huge role in it, because it wasn't until recently that everyone sat around wondering if we were happy, which, by the way, I think sometimes is a surefire way to feel quite depressed. But, I mean, it's what you did. You got married, and you had children, and you had this lifestyle, and you lived, what is it, Keeping Up with the Joneses?
Yeah.
It's just what you did
and
then.
And you never questioned it.
No. So the fact that someone's actually asking, do you love me? And it's like, I feel the same way I felt about you the day I married you. So you were happy then, be happy now. Like,
yeah.
Just so different compared to us all sitting around today wondering if we're happy.
Yeah. If I, like, had asked my... whatever.
You can't even mention it.
She would respond that way. If you knew I felt about you the way I've always felt, my next question would be like, and how is that?
I want a specific.
I want you to tell me those four, that four letter word. Yes, say it. Love, me, you, yes, us.
But love is thrown around so easily these days,
yes.
Where back then it was very, especially I think in upper class families, they didn't go around holding hands and kissing each other in public. It was professional. It was it was the societal thing.
It was like that holiday cocktail party that Beth and Calvin went to.
Yeah.
And then Beth thought that Calvin had had a few too many drinks because he was disclosing about.
Yeah, she was upset about that.
Yeah.
My question. It's unrelated to the cocktail party. Is Kelvin's co-worker? I'm still trying to figure out like how he played, like what his role was, because he had a couple scenes where he would like talk to Calvin, and you kind of like, I was kind of confused. He just like kept rambling about something, and then they were running, and then they went their separate ways, and then like Calvin started like running sporadically, and then he started having a flashback, and then he fell.
Yes.
I was trying to figure out like, what did that symbolize for Calvin? Because you never saw that friend like with anyone else. It was always like him and Calvin outside of their like work establishment. And he was always talking about something that had nothing to do with like the movie. It was kind of, I was trying to figure out like, why was it so irrelevant? I know it was relevant, but I was trying to figure out, like, the conversation. Like, was he just trying to talk just because, like, you know, his friend's going through something? Or I want to know what everybody else thought.
Yeah, my first guess, I haven't contemplated this before. It's so funny, again, because I've seen this movie a lot, and even during this conversation, what you all are talking about are things I've never thought about, and I'm just kind of marveling at it. So, in response to what you're asking, Tony, I'm thinking right now, so Calvin worked as a tax attorney or accountant, tax accountant, and that's what his coworker did. And so I'm thinking that we're seeing that Calvin's social life or his kind of his guy friend contact is just really this mundane situation. And so in the running scene, which is one of my favorite scenes, we're interspersing this mundane tax accountant information with the trauma that's happened in this family. And Calvin, it's getting all jumbled. And then, as you said, he trips and falls while he's running.
And I think it could have just been writing a character in that needed to be there, because who else would Calvin have had those conversations with? It wasn't going to happen with any of the main characters. So it's like the writer being like, let's draw someone in here who can just, you know, I think we see that in a lot of movies where it's like, we need that one character that's going to bring out this line that we want this person to say.
Yeah.
I think it's great that you were thinking about it, but I find myself overthinking it sometimes with like side characters. Like sometimes they're just there.
Yeah. I think also if you just wanted to analyze it, thinking in terms of Buck and Conrad, they eventually have to venture off on paths, and I don't remember the friend coming back up after that. So it's kind of like having them together discussing things as usual. This incident happened. Now things can't go back to what it used to be, and he ends up falling, drowning. Now how do I pick myself back up and go on?
Yeah, you kind of see like what Kelvin and his coworker are going through is kind of like what Conrad and the other friend are going through.
So
it's kind of like a parallel, because he can't just go back to talking about like mundane like tax stuff and traveling and just act like everything's okay. And Conrad can't just go back to hanging out with him. He said like, I remember the friend saying, you know, I miss him too. We were always together, the three of us, and then Conrad goes like, it hurts too much to be around you, which is really like a real thing, because a lot of people in my opinion, I would think that a lot of families, like when there's a death like of a child, a lot of families do separate because it just hurts to be around that person. And it was just like, I was watching it like, wow, that's interesting. The character never showed up after that. You don't know what happened to him. It was kind of like, sometimes you just have to let a person go because it just hurts.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really real moment, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Okay, someone that we haven't talked about yet, and I really like her in this movie, is the character of Janine Pratt, who is, I believe she, her family has just moved to Lake Forest, and so she's new at Lake Forest High School. I keep saying Lake Forest High School. It's actually, I think, Lake Forest Academy.
Mm.
But so they start out with the choir scene, and Janine compliments him on his singing voice and says, I think you should be the lead tenor. And Conrad sings back like, do you really mean that?
Yeah. Something it was so
like,
cute.
It
was
yeah.
Cute. He was like happy for like a really split second.
And then, and so they start to get to know each other. There's like that little awkward scene. And we see Conrad practicing his phone call. Hello, Jane.
Yeah.
This is Conrad. And it comes to the McDonald's scene, which I feel affection for, because I believe that's the McDonald's on Green Bay Road in Waukegan. But Janine sees the vertical lines on his wrists. And of course, vertical lines means you're really trying to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Really? I always thought it was horizontal.
I think it's vertical. Oh. And yeah, I might have it
the
reversed.
The way the veins run.
Oh. Mine's not doing
that. Yeah. And
not giving
so,
suggestions here, by the way.
So Conrad, for the first time ever, is able to talk to somebody about, she says, to the effect of, you know, why did you do it? And he's mm-hmm. just starting to talk about that. And a bunch of the peers come in, possibly in varsity jackets.
Yep, the jerks always wear the jackets.
And they start to put on a McDonald's hat, and they might sing a McDonald's song, I don't remember. And it's just totally disruptive. And then Conrad, I think he feels a little rejection or something. And even though Janine says, no, I want you to call me. I want to go out. He's like, yeah, whatever. And then there's a scene toward the end where they're talking again outside. And he says something like, do you want to, are you going to be in school today or whatever? She's like, well, it's a Sunday. But so their relationship kind of grows and develops throughout the movie. And I'm just wondering what thoughts you had about that relationship.
Well, I know it's the 80s, so I'm not going to say anything about them going on a date at McDonald's. I did not know they were at McDonald's. Like, I thought it was just like, oh, let's go bowling and we're eating inside.
Oh, the bowling! That bowling was funny, too.
Yeah, I thought it was really cute.
Maybe I'm wrong about that.
Oh, no, I'm going to take your word for it. But it's okay, it was the 80s. It's different now. I liked that it was like a, you can tell it was developing, but it wasn't just like in movies now where it's like, oh my God, we're gonna fall in love in 2 hours. So I like her character because she kind of like wanted to know, but she didn't try to like be overbearing about it, like tell me everything. And she didn't really like tiptoe around him as much because you can tell like mm-hmm. she wasn't too afraid to ask him. And you can tell it, like, in certain, like, scenes when Conrad, like, when they were leaving quiet the second time and he already had his jacket on, but then he, like, made a U-turn and walked back, took his jacket off, and then walked back again to make it look like he was just leaving so she'd notice him. I thought those were really, like, those were reminders that, like, he's still in high school and he does things that high school kids still do, and the whole, like, trying to call and then... when he stood outside her house all morning. Well, I didn't want to call. I didn't want to wake anyone up. So you're just going to wait outside until she got there. It was, I thought it was cute. And it was a nice change of pace to show, like, you know, things were on the up and up with him.
I saw it similarly. I thought that was very hopeful. I thought that they did a really great job with kind of showing that his character had hope for the future, that this was, you know, something that happened to him that is huge and sustaining and whatnot, but it's not the end all tell all for this character. He's going to have, like, a life ahead of him, and that's kind of one of the ways they showed it. I think they also did a great job with the other main characters, though, showing that it doesn't always work that way. Like, Mary Tyler Moore's character may never get over this and come back from it. Sometimes you don't. And I just think that they had kind of this great dynamic, and that was a part of the way to bring that out of him, this hopefulness for the future.
Yeah, I would say it was very hopeful. I appreciated her directness about asking him, and then I think it also could serve as a way to say we can talk about these things and not make it so, oh, we don't talk about those things, but I think it also helps because not only is he someone who has interest in him, but you're talking about it out in the open. It's not some private area. Mm-hmm. So to say, let's talk about it because it happened and I want to know what happened, but I'm still interested in you. And it doesn't change that my interest in you.
Yeah.
And their relationship almost seemed to be a barometer of Conrad's mental health. I'll just leave it at that. So thinking from a more meta perspective, mm-hmm. What do we think about first? What do we think about what was the message being sent? And this is based on a novel, I should have said at the beginning, by Judith Guest. So Judith Guest as author, Robert Redford as director, somebody else adapted the novel for a screenplay. What message are they sending to us about mental health issues and professional helping?
I think it's very encouraging. It shows all different sides where support is big. He had support from his father, at least. And then in the other case with his friend Karen, not so much support, and how, you know, sometimes it works for one person while it may not work for others. And if their family isn't, you know, really saying, let's work through this, let's figure out what's going on. And then not even the peer group as well, like the swim coach. And I think for me, him saying, okay, I just have to miss practice then, that in itself was like sacrifice. Even if it wasn't because, oh, well, this was my brother's sport anyway. But in itself, I know that this seems to be something I want to test out. And if I have to miss some practices and even quit, you know, it's worth it. Versus saying like, oh, I'm going to always be a mandated person coming to see you. And my family is going to be totally on board and it's always going to be family counseling. No, it's going to be different dynamics. And then sometimes the family comes in. Sometimes it's always individual, such as when the father came in and it wasn't a session with his son. So I think it shows you that it's not always everyone willing to do it. But those who do come and put forth the work, you know, it can be rewarding for you.
Yeah, I would say that along with that, it shows that psychiatry isn't as like sterile and formal as other like people assume. Just because it's in the medical field, it's not like you go to a hospital and you have to like put on like an apron or whatever and like talk to a doctor. I think it shows you that like psychiatry is still a form of counseling, very loose interpretation depending, just because you do have to go through medical school, but it's still counseling. And it shows like what you said about like not everyone is going to be supportive of you. I think it shows that the client can be really wanting to go, and members of the family could be really objecting. Also that certain areas of your life can get better while other areas of your life get worse. Like, mm-hmm. Here Conrad has forgiven himself. He's like feeling better. He has a love interest, but his parents are separating. So just because like one thing is getting better doesn't mean other things don't get bad. Mm-hmm. And I think it shows that it doesn't matter where you're from, like the most affluent families still can be broken. Because a lot of people just think that, you know, if you're in an affluent society and you have money, that your life is perfect, mm-hmm. when it's really not.
I guess I think there's just like a lot of themes in this film, and some of them are still even relevant today. I think it really broke down gender norms, especially for the early 80s. Mm-hmm. I think about bereavement, you know, is something that I keep thinking about with this film when I was watching it. The idea that, like, it's still a V-code, like, when it comes to, like, loss and grief, that we don't really see depression. I mean, there's adjustment disorder, which I guess could kind of go into, yeah. like, an actual... But, I mean, a lot of insurance companies don't cover adjustment disorders and whatnot. So the idea that we're looking at someone's huge, potential, life-changing loss as something that isn't even covered by insurance, that isn't even considered a disorder outside of bereavement, is just so upsetting to me, I guess. Because those are two very different things, bereavement or adjustment and depression. And I guess, I mean, it was 40 years ago and we still have a V code for a loss in your family, losing a child. So that's what I kept thinking about over and over in this whole thing is that, you know, we have this thing as human beings when we don't like something, we get rid of it. And when it comes to our feelings and thoughts, sometimes you can't just get rid of them. And sometimes it's actually like lying with them and learning how to be comfortable again with nothing's ever going to be okay again, but we're going to find a new okay. And some people don't. Sometimes you don't come back from something like that.
Like Beth.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that either. Her life dramatically changed. She's allowed to be sad and to be like, oh, well, is it 2 months after? Now it's depression versus bereavement. Like, I don't know. I just thought about that a lot and that it's still happening in our DSM today.
Yeah, the insurance thing was interesting. He's like, $50 for an hour.
Right?
I was like,
but it's bereavement and it's not, and it's adjustment.
It is cheap.
But imagine what that was back then.
Oh, yeah, probably, I'm guessing it would translate to about 200 or so, 250.
Twice a week?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not even, I was interested that he went twice a week instead of once a week.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's just a, like, time thing or maybe
no yes. I think that because Conrad asked Dr. Berger why twice or something like that, and he said he thought the nature of the issue that Conrad was dealing with probably was a 2-time-a-week issue.
So what did you think?
Well, the first word that comes to my mind is hope. That I mean, throughout it all, Conrad, who tried to kill himself, but he was resilient. And he tried to connect with his mother in a healthy way, and unfortunately she wasn't able to respond. But she had her own way of trying to hold things together and keep functioning in the world, and that's how she was doing it. And I just want to clarify on the gender norms. And so I think you're referring to Calvin and Beth and their parental roles.
Yeah.
Is that correct? Because Calvin being the more nurturing parent and Beth being the more rigid one. Mm-hmm. So hope in that through working with mental health professionals that we can become healthier. Additionally, I think it comes down to the title as well, Ordinary People. And these are ordinary people put into extraordinary circumstances, and they all were coping in their own ways in the best way that they knew how. Conrad in particular was working with a mental health professional. He seems to have made the most progress. Followed by Calvin, and then Beth. It was too difficult for her. In fact, she had to leave the situation in order to cope. Mm-hmm. So we're coming to a close. I wanted to see if there's anything else that was on your mind that we hadn't discussed.
My only thing, I thought it was interesting how, what a positive, depiction you guys had of the therapist or the psychiatrist in this film, because I actually didn't.
Interesting.
I mean, I didn't dislike him, but I thought he was very one-dimensional this time around. I didn't really... I mean, I see kind of a little bit what you were saying with the, like, not playing that typical role and challenging and being kind of like Robin Williams' character in Good Will Hunting. But I saw them as very one-dimensional. And, like, even just when he did call and needed that help in the middle of the night after finding out that the friend had died, I was like, my clients don't have my phone number. They're not getting a hold of me in the middle of the night. Like, maybe I'm a bad therapist or something.
I think it was just the
80s. Yeah, but, I mean, I guess it just, it was such a stereotypical thing. Like, they're going to be there when I pick up. Like, very DBT of them.
Well, yeah. I did wonder about that, too.
Yeah, and I guess I didn't, and, you know, unless they were actually coming in as a family, I thought it was incredibly inappropriate for him to see the father and the son, unless it was, like, an actual family counseling kind of thing, which it wasn't. So, because I would never see like the parent or the spouse or the anything of a client that I'm already seeing.
I agree with that. My interpretation as I watched it was that Calvin had come in sort of as a consultant on Dr. Berger's work with Conrad. But then it morphed into, I guess I need to talk about my own things. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
And I don't recall, I was alive in 1980. I was 16. Great time in my life. I was working at a record store. But I wasn't familiar with the ethical codes of the American Psychiatric Association at the time. And so I don't know what thoughts were. I know that, you know, it's evolved.
Yeah.
So, you know, one thing, this is not going to probably go anywhere. In Good Will Hunting, one thing we didn't touch on was the soundtrack. And there's some great songs by Elliott Smith, who himself, like Robin Williams, killed himself in a rather violent way. In as I was watching this film, I noticed Cannon and D, Paco Bell, they would come into it at specific times, and I didn't know if they were signaling anything with that. I may have to even rewatch.
I know. I watched it twice this weekend, and I'm going to go home and watch it again. Because everyone brought up such different things.
I know.
Wait, the music is that like... Is
that the graduation?
There was, I don't know what it was.
I specifically remember there was some like piano.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it graduation? Because there was something that I was like, is that like the wedding song or something? Like it just wasn't.
I think it's
wasn't...
the graduation song. Like that every graduation they play Canon and D.
Okay, is that what it is?
Is it called Circumstance? I don't know.
Oh, that's true. Maybe I'm way off.
We'll have to look this up again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
That's what I was going to ask. I was going to ask your opinion on the doctor because we never got back to it.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't hate him. I just, you know what I mean? Like, I thought it was fine and it was there. But since we are focused on the role of the counselor, the role of the helper at some point, I didn't have as positive of a reaction as I did with Robin Williams' character.
You didn't get much backstory on him.
No.
He didn't self-disclose anything.
And the whole, like, being there in the middle of the night, like, I was just like, all right, now I'm done. I've given up.
He doesn't have a life. He's waiting on the phone.
Shouldn't there have been a crisis line or something that he called it?
Usually, when I call the doctor... like, to make an appointment, the first thing they say is, if this is life-threatening, hang up and dial 911. But then again, this is not 1980.
Yeah. Where we didn't have 911 in 1980.
Seriously?
We didn't have 911 even when I was younger until, like, fourth or fifth grade. Yeah, it wasn't something we grew up with.
And I guess it's amazing.
Not a good movie.
Yeah, well, I mean, we've attributed a lot to 1980 in this discussion, some of which conflicts with my memories of 1980. but I am thinking in terms of the development of professional helping, that our profession, counseling, was kind of in infancy or maybe a toddler or, mm-hmm. you know, kindergarten. I'll say kindergarten at that time. And I think maybe now that psychiatrists are more likely to do the 15 minutes of medication management, whereas maybe at that time, and then mental health talk counseling comes from actual counselors, whereas maybe in 1980, there weren't as many professional counselors, and so psychiatrists were providing that service.
Yeah.
I'm speculating. Any final thoughts?
Oh, I was just thinking that that's interesting. Because it could seem like they pushed away from that once we were here. It's like, oh, they can do that. But then I also think of society. It definitely had a push towards like immediacy. And so them sticking to medical purposes. You need a medication. Or am I going to feel this for you or not? Based it off of a brief conversation. Yeah. So, and counseling more whole.
So I think that we'll stop here with our discussion about ordinary people. I can't wait to go home and watch it again. And just kind of a foreshadowing for next week, we'll be talking about Antoine Fisher, starring Denzel Washington. And just like how this was Robert Redford's first time directing, Antoine Fisher was first time for Denzel to direct a film. And he also stars in it.
And you get to lead.
Yes, and then Tony will lead our discussion.
I've loved all the actors in these movies so far.
It's great.
I'm a big fan of Donald Sutherland.
Oh, yes.
Through and through.
Yeah. Father of Kiefer Sutherland.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll be back next week.
Awesome.
All right.
Thanks so much.